This is Xformation, brought to you by the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. I'm Will, and today, like always, I'm joined by my colleague, Caden. Hey, Caden.
How's it going on this Friday?
Well. Going well. Friday. Oof. Yeah. I know we've been trying to record this one for a bit.
This is going to be our most timely episode yet.
It is. Right? Coming in.
It'll come out just a couple days. Everybody's
I know. So, big news is happening, right? Or at least
what's happening.
Well, I mean, we got this infrastructure deal, right? I've been following this pretty closely. I've been following this since the beginning of this year, obviously. Yeah. And it seems obviously something happened in the Senate. We had this passage in the Senate, 2,700 pages, 2,700 pages,
2,702. My count. I looked.
Hey, thanks.
Scrolled all the way to the end, and I looked at the top of the page. 2,702.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, this is a big bill. You know, side note, I've always wanted somebody to look into the amount of actual text that passages or that are included in bills, right? Because everyone says, oh, you know, fewer and fewer pieces of legislation are getting passed. I'm unclear about that, right? I think that probably more. Like you have a singular bill that has far more provisions because you have to, you know, you have to pass it in, you know, as we're going to try to do through this a singular bill, or you're going to try to pass it through a, you know, budget resolution or something along those lines. Anyway. Yeah. So yes, this bill.
Well, I mean, we talked about this with Sam McKenzie, right? Our former student fellow. We had a lunch with him. We talked about this, and the question boiled down to which way is better, passing a bunch of bills or just having one bill all at once. Once you finally reach a total compromise, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
interesting.
It is interesting. I wish we did have numbers on it.
So we're talking about this Senate bill. It passed the Senate. It's big, right? It's pretty massive. I mean, it's looking at least at $1 trillion, the Senate side, and up to $3 trillion on the House. So it'll be kind of interesting to see.
Yeah. I mean, $3.5 trillion. You can't leave out the half. Half a trillion. It's still pretty significant. No, it's very significant.
Right. And that is, you know, stepping back for a second, right? That this to me is the huge problem that we're facing even to begin with, right? These numbers are both massive and they're kind of all over the place.
Right.
And really where I think this is obviously kind of central is this part that obviously I care about the most because I've been doing a lot of research in broadband. But it's the broadband portion, right? It's this $65 billion is going to get spent on broadband.
Which is interesting because it's no longer the $80 billion that we were talking about last time, 10 episodes ago.
Yeah, possibly. Which was down then from the $100 billion, which we were talking about earlier in the year, right? Before we even started doing this podcast, there was the higher level of $100 billion.
Right.
So you're exactly right. There's this kind of flexibility that's going on even with this conversation that – to me seems to be, I mean, I don't know. I worry about this sort of way of doing projects and doing infrastructure projects in particular.
At the same time, it's still representative of political compromise across the aisles to reach a solution that they can agree on. Right.
Yes.
And so the fact that it's coming down closer to the numbers that we would agree are supported by economics is probably reassuring for you, right?
Yes. Well, so yes and no on that point, right? I mean, yes to the fact that this is, you know, the way, and we can get into this here shortly, but the way to actually think about this problem, especially when you're thinking about broadband, is that you have to figure out how much you need to be targeted, right? So let's get into this. Just so the current bill itself is about $65 billion, or the Senate is about $65 billion altogether total for broadband. Yeah. Around $14 billion of that is going to extend EBB, right? So this is the Emergency Broadband Benefit Program, which
what is that exactly?
So basically, this program gives households a $50 per month benefit. It's like a voucher. Well, it's not technically a voucher, but it's a benefit that they can get this to pay for the service that they want. They can pay for internet service. Okay. So I think that generally this is what's been talked about for quite some time, right? It's a support mechanism that goes after demand for a household, right? You're trying to basically solve the cost problem. If you've got multiple different kinds of problems related to broadband service, one of them is that some people cannot afford the service itself. Like they have access to service, they have access to broadband internet, but they just don't have the ability to pay for it.
So refresh my memory. Which side is the best side to attack? Is it both sides or is it supply side?
At this point, I think it's almost all demand side, right? I think it really, yeah. I mean, not all demand side, right? There's obviously gaps and problems. And I think let's just say that at least with this $14 billion that it's going to extend the emergency broadband benefit program, the thing that I think is going to be really, really critical, and I'm pretty sure that this is included within the provision, is hopefully if they do it correctly, the FCC is going to have to actually go back and look at this program and see how well it's done and see how well it's been effective, right?
Yeah.
That's at least one of, if from my understanding, that's one of the provisions. But the reason why it's slightly smaller, it's only $14 billion, is because they're actually taking away money. They're previously, at least the previous program was $50 a month, uh-huh. and now the new number is $30 a month. And
how did they get there? Was that just like pulled out of a hat?
Negotiation? All right. I don't know. But then, I mean, it's kind of grisly to talk about it, but that gives you this ability to figure out how it's helped people in that, because you're going to have a very, very clean shift, right? You'll have a clean shift between this $50 per month and then the new level of $30 per month. So I think if you were to kind of set up the program and set up the idea and study well enough, you could kind of figure out how effective the emergency, the EBB actually is, depending on that.
Well, that sounds exciting.
Yeah. But that's probably exciting for you. I mean, I know that you were saying
there's no way to see the effectiveness of it. Last time we talked about this, maybe not on the podcast, but at least in our discussions, we were talking about the fact that we didn't actually know how effective the rural benefit programs were, the emergency benefit programs were. This could be one of the ways, right?
This would be a good
kind of grisly.
It is kind of grisly, right? But it also does, and it will be able to tell you at least something of what's going on, right? You'll be able to put bounds around the impacts. But then again, I guess that's the other problem, right? You don't necessarily know if $30 is the correct level or $50 is the correct level. Or perhaps even higher, right? Like $70 or $80 or $100 for specific kinds of families. Maybe there's centrally important families that can connect or be kind of important in connecting a whole group of different individuals, right? And you don't necessarily know what that level would look like.
And there's something like, 4 million people already signed up for this program, this emergency benefit program?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty big, right?
There's a lot of people involved. Yeah.
There is a lot of people involved. So let's talk about the actual thing, the actual bigger part of this, right? So we have the EBB, that's $14 billion, but then we're going to spend $42.5 billion in broadband grants.
Okay, all right. How does this broadband grant program work? Is this the dreaded reverse auction?
So this is not actually, they're actually not doing a reverse auction on this one. This one is, the way that the bill is currently written, it's basically just going to be this dispersal methods. It's a formula that goes directly to the states. I haven't looked, I think I did this, some time ago and just looked at generally if they used a dispersal method, what would go to each one of the states.
What does that mean? Like they send money to the states for that purpose of
it's like broadband. You get $100 million every single state gets like $100 million or something along those levels, right? And then you build on top of that depending on how many people are in your state that don't have or are not connected to the internet. I'll look deeper into that, but I know that's generally they're doing dispersal method, so they're giving it directly to states instead of running their own sort of auction, which is what the FCC has done for a couple of years, right?
Right. So, we talked about the RDOF auction a while ago and how the FCC still had the money. It hadn't dispersed it yet.
Yeah.
Right. So
yeah, there's like a second tranche that it still has not yet to go through.
Would you say that the state way of doing it is possibly better?
I don't know. I'm actually in the middle of a project right now to figure that out. So
really,
I'm trying to figure what that looks like. I'm trying to figure out if there is better economic outcomes for a state directed grant because they have, local knowledge. That's kind of I'm working on this paper right now. This is the big thing I've been working on. Yeah.
So I'm just asking you questions that have no answers yet.
Hopefully we'll have some answers, but I think that what you're hinting at, or at least what you're getting at more, what you're very directly getting at is this, the difference between a federal level administration and state level administration, right? Is there a quality difference between these two levels of administration? And I think that's a big and open question. This bill clearly goes down the state route. It is clearly giving money towards states and directing states to kind of just figure it out on their own. what we've done, at least in the past. It is kind of an interesting way of doing this, right? I mean, the method of all of this, however, I think was probably pretty screwed up to begin with, because instead of doing, you know, I mean, we kind of laughed about how there was this negotiation between 60, 80, you know, and $100 billion dollars. But the actual way to figure out this problem is that you have to establish that there's a gap in certain kinds of communities, right? You have to map out all the regions that have broadband and then set a certain kind of threshold for the service that you want to exist in all of those regions, wherever those regions may be. Mm-hmm. And then from there, then you can calculate the cost that it's going to take to plug all of those gaps. And so that process never, ever, ever went on with the FCC.
So you say a lot that we don't have these FCC maps, but
I was
like 90% sure that there was a new FCC map out that said broadband map, right?
Yeah.
Is something wrong with it or?
Oh, no. That's major carrier. So that'd be wireless, right? So it's wireless, wireless map, not necessarily a fixed map. And there's two different maps that are going on that the FCC works on. Okay. You've got this wireless cellular map, and that has its own sort of problems, right? Mm-hmm. But then you have the fixed map, the fixed broadband map, and it's really where you're trying to get hard line connections into the ground. And so the processes are slightly different. And also, you know, there has been some targeting of cellular technologies and of doing, you know, cellular development. But for the most part, that's really not a big or super huge part of this conversation. It hasn't been as big of the part of conversation quite some time. I mean, and maybe that will shift in the future, right? Maybe there will be more insistence on getting every single area, not just connected to a fixed fiber connection or a fixed connection, but something that is ensuring that everyone has access to wireless service as well. So needless to say, after you've done these, you know, these two things, you map out the regions that don't have broadband, you set the threshold for the service, and then you calculate the cost that it would take to plug all of these gaps. Yeah. Then you have to run some sort of mechanism to actually provide that service. So the thing that I worry about is that, okay, let's just take a step back. So we really don't know how much money we're supposed to be targeting in these regions anyway, right? We don't have an upper threshold. I mean, most people are saying probably $40 billion, but mm-hmm. that projection came from 2017. Yeah. And it was based on 2015 data, right? And the market's changed pretty dramatically. So we kind of need to start with something new. We need to start with something or expectations that are probably a little bit better. And effectively, I think that what that means is that this current infrastructure bill is probably going to overshoot, right? There's probably going to be too much money coming in to these areas that and we really don't know where it should be going and where it should be directed to. So there's probably going to be a lot of variability. Some states are probably going to do very, very well, in the sense that it might actually be helpful. You know, you can understand a lot of rural or more or less dense areas. You can think of, you know, problems in, say, West Virginia or Louisiana that have had kind of long scale issues. Though they may actually do better, and they may actually kind of win in this situation because they have more money to kind of dole out. But then you think of large, you know, large states like California. I think that you have to wonder. I have to wonder. California's had a project, has had a broadband grant project for, you know, going on over a decade now, almost a decade.
Decades.
And then you sent them CARES money, and they're going to use however many billions for broadband. And
plus, if it's $100 million plus the amount of people you have, California has a lot of people.
Yes. We could find the graph of how much each of these states has been projected to effectively get in underneath these different projects. I think California, given that it's probably $40 billion, I mean, California is probably on the $2 or $3 billion they'd get from something like this, right?
Yeah.
I did this somewhere, right? And we'll put this in the show notes. But the point being is that you're
economist.
You just game it out, right? You just throw some numbers on the board and see what happens. And who knows if you're good about it? You've got to look back in your predictions in the future anyway.
Right.
But the point being is that I guess my worry here is that properly targeting money to the areas that clearly need it, that's something that I worry about, especially with this type of function that you just give money directly to states, right? And then the states deal with it as they may. But that means that there's going to be a lot of variability in the kinds of outputs that you're going to get from this project.
It also means there's a lot of state experimentation, though, right?
Like, yes,
we
yes,
can figure out yes. what the best rollout is if a bunch of states try different ways of doing it. And I think that's an important point, because when it comes to internet access, the states know their citizens better than the federal government would. And yeah. if they want to dole it out to local counties and do it that way, then the local counties know their citizens better than the whole state does. And maybe that's one way of doing it. Who knows? They experiment with it. And I think that's important in terms that of broadband important. Access, because they're actually on the ground instead of, you know, up here where we are, where we're just looking at the numbers.
Totally. Totally. And I think that I'm holding reservations about this, right? Okay. I'm holding reservations about the outputs that we're going to see. Yeah. Primarily because, you know, we've had obviously this kind of federal way of doing things. We've had this federal reverse auction, and that has a certain, or it should have some sort of, you know, benefit or output or whatever. You know, we should be able to find some sort of direct relationship between the two.
Yeah.
And you're exactly right. This is going to give us kind of a new experiment. It's going to give us yet another way of looking and seeing how well things are either doing at the states or not doing at the states,
right.
and doing well at the federal government or not doing well at the federal government. And that's again, but the problem, I guess part of the problem here is that, again, we don't know how much we should be targeting. So even with RDOF, you know, came in the most recent tranche in RDOF, that actually came in under the expected value, right? So the amount of money they thought they were going to spend, it so far they've come in less than that, because the areas that have been connected with service have been connected with service at a lower, you know, at a lower rate.
It was cheaper than they thought.
Yeah,
right?
It was cheaper. Yeah. So they're basically being able to provide, or at least seemingly being able to provide service to rural areas at a cheaper rate than what the FCC last did the, you know, the model to support these rural areas.
Well, then let me ask you this. What happens to the excess funds if it comes in cheaper than they expected?
They're just going to have to redeploy that money at some point in the future.
Got it. Okay. So it's not that it just goes back to the treasury.
Yeah, that's going to happen in 2022, I think. So probably, what is it, next year? I think the next year you run another tranche of RDOF. Right. And then so you got RDOF, you got that the states are doing, states already have previous money from CARES Act, and now we have, on top of that, the infrastructure bill.
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of money that's going to be swimming around for broadband.
We're going to get some internet access.
Are we?
So help us.
Will we?
Well, it seems like if you throw enough money at it, it should be getting the job done.
Okay. So anyway, all right. So I guess I'm just stopping this conversation before
let's move on to the other point, because there have been some surveys put out. You wrote about it on the Substack.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks that access to the internet is going to be this huge economic benefit.
Yeah.
And they're citing all kinds of surveys and studies about it. Not all the surveys and studies actually say what the conclusion is about better benefits, right?
Yeah, yeah. So the Wall Street Journal, and again, we'll put this in show notes. Wall Street Journal had an article up where they actually cited two studies showing that expanding high quality internet access could have significant economic benefits. And so there's two of them, right? One of them I actually agree with pretty clearly, because it shows it shows access to markets, right? So I'll come back to that. Yeah. But this first one showed there's clear access to markets. So, but the other survey that was included in it was from the Aspen Economic Strategy Group. And they basically said that universal high-speed internet service would raise labor productivity by 1.1% using the results of a survey. Surveys are not good ways of measuring productivity, just purely,
not at all.
Right? Not
yeah,
at
I mean-
all.
I woke up this morning saying to myself, I am going to be productive about vacuuming my bedroom.
Yep.
And I did not do it.
You're going to be 1.1% more productive at vacuuming your bedroom.
I have a 1.1% chance of actually doing it.
Right? Exactly. So this is like, no, surveys are not the way to do this. And I don't know why, but it took me a really long time to kind of have all the dots connect on this.
Yeah.
But I guess I just don't understand why I was so blind about it for so long. But
well, I mean, it's the Wall Street Journal, not the Motley Fool.
Not the, yes.
Right? I mean, it's a pretty credible news source. It's not.
Yeah, no. I still like some of the stuff on Motley Fool, though.
It's fun.
And Seeking Alpha. That one's a little.
I definitely would not trade on
No, of course not.
Based on the Motley Fool. But like the Wall Street Journal, if it tells me something's happening, I typically think that's probably got some
merit
there.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And this really has been, but I mean, because it fits this idea, this study fits into a lot of other studies, which seem to suggest that when broadband comes into a region, the economics or the, you know, you have economic development in that region.
Yeah.
That's actually not really correct, right? And as I said, as I explained, there's a dirty little secret of broadband, right? It's not the game changer that many people think it is. Economists use this term. It's called a general purpose technology or GPT. Okay. General purpose technologies, the big one, the most important one is electricity, right? Electricity is a general purpose technology. And when it comes into an area, it transforms productivity. It makes people more productive, right? It's with electricity that you can do a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Now, the thing that's really, really interesting about this is that broadband is not like electricity. It's not a GPT. What the general purpose technologies are actually cell phones and computers. So it's
Wanted to push back on that just a little bit.
Yeah.
Because electricity wasn't all that useful until people bought, you know, enough light bulbs to really need electricity to light their homes. Mm-hmm. Until we started using central heat and air and we needed to plug in those things. Electricity could, you know, I would argue wasn't a GPT until enough people used that it span. Is the internet not the same way, right? It's these devices create the demand that makes you need the internet.
No, but the demand is not the demand creation is, it does actually happen with broadband, right? So when you're talking about demand creation, that's still like a market. What we're talking about is let's take all of this away, right? Does the existence of broadband or not broadband matter for productivity if you're an individual? And it doesn't.
Okay.
What matters is your cell phone, right? Your cellular phone. That is actually the thing that matters. Now, obviously, you have to have broadband as the input. But this, but the point being is that when you look at general purpose technologies always increase productivity. That's like their fundamental attribute. Right. They change your ability to do things in the world. Now, broadband does allow you to be connected and interconnected with a whole bunch of individuals. Right. That's clearly the case.
But there's a difference between productivity and well-being. Right.
Exactly. Right. There's a difference between opening up new markets and new productivity. You can have
a whole piece on this.
Yeah.
You know, where workers were super productive during the pandemic, but they also had a lot of issues. They were not feeling very well because they were locked up in their apartments. So the internet can make you happy. You can watch Netflix, but just because you have access to the internet doesn't mean that's your job to watch Netflix. Sometimes it's, you know, it's the people building HQ2 right next to me. They don't need the internet to you know, pour concrete and do what they're doing. They just use it when they get home as a consumer product, right?
Yes. Or more importantly, that it's the computer that is running and doing all the calculations for the concrete, right?
Yeah, all the CAD.
That all of that is the most important stuff, not the inputs for the CAD, right? So it's like the CAD is what's important. That's the productivity enhancing technology. That's and that is built on top of the computer, or it's built on top of the phone, right? So the general purpose technology is the actual, like, the actual infrastructure of it, right? The handset or in this case, you know, your desktop. Those are the general purpose technologies, and it's not broadband.
Well, I feel like this is where a lot of people get lost in this conversation. This
I know
is
it's
the
a really mundane
nuance,
point,
right?
And it seems like really, really esoteric. But I think it's actually really crucial, because broadband is important and it's an important input, but it's not going to change a region economically. It's not going to massively change a region in a way that you'd want productivity increases, right? Now, you might
my
see
favorite little,
sales
My
choices.
Favorite little anecdote is... people will say that, you know, access to the internet is going to change the world, but then people also say, turn off your phone and sit with nature for a while. That'll help your state of mind, which is going to help the world if you're not in a crazy state of mind. There's a flip there, right? No one's recognizing that the internet isn't just the end all be all of progress.
Yes, yes, yes. But more importantly, that broadband only is an input and is only transformative in a very specific sort of way, right?
Yeah.
The actual thing that's transformative, again, is the cell phone. It's not the broadband, right? It's like, what's the most important thing about the cell phone is the its pack of technologies that connects to the internet. And it's not necessarily mm-hmm. the pure connection to the internet that's the important thing, right? Because you could yeah. you could have an in anyway, I'm still kind of teasing this out, to be very, very honest, because this idea of GPTs, the general purpose technologies, and the studies, and again, we'll put in these studies, there is a lot of uncertainty about this, right? We're still kind of in an early nascent stage with these technologies. We're only looking at, say, even the cell phone. The cell phone's, what, 10 years old, 12 years old, something like that, 13 years old at this point? Not like the actual smartphone. I'm talking about like the post-iPhone world, right?
It's got to be at least the same age as me. Because I think
it was 2007 that it came out. It came out in 2007.
The first cell phone?
Not the first cell phone. No. The first like smartphone. The first like.
Got it. Like the, that little.
I mean the handset. The handset.
Yeah, I remember this.
iPhone revolution. Right. I'm not talking about the other previous stuff that came about. You know, BlackBerry had something that was important, but the actual.
It's still only been like 14 years.
Yeah. So it hasn't really been that long.
No, not at all. But there's the general purpose technology angle, right, where all the surveys are going and mixing up productivity. But then there's the access to the markets angle.
Yes. Yeah, so what I think that – so my sense here, having looked at the literature, and again, it is a very esoteric point, is that what broadband does is generally open up new markets, right? It opens mm-hmm. up the market in a region. So what ends up happening is – you know, and these are two separate but related things. So mm-hmm. in as much as I'm saying that broadband doesn't really change productivity, right? And productivity really simply is just doing more with the same amount of outputs, right? Or the same amount of inputs, right? Having more output with the same amount of inputs. That is not occurring with broadband. But what is important are the technologies that are connected to it, obviously the cell phone and all of those kind of related things. But what the mm-hmm. broadband actually does do, and what we can see that it probably is clearly connected to, is opening up new sorts of communications and new sorts of markets. So new markets are basically connecting to each other. So one of the big studies about this is you know, in particular farmers. So when you look at farmers and when farmers get broadband, their productivity doesn't change all that much, it doesn't seem. But what does change, in fact, are their ability to get new sales in new areas. Right. So because they're able to go online and basically sell stuff for slightly, you know, better prices or however it may be, or find new people that are willing to buy their products, whatever they may be.
Yeah.
So in that sense, that's kind of what we're seeing is this shift of sales, not of productivity. And in that case, what you're seeing with broadband coming into markets is economic shifts and economic changes, because they're basically local product market changes. But they're not the kind of productivity shifts that you would want to see with a general purpose technology. And I'm still trying to work out how to like even explain this because it seems to me
like
there's like,
that was
excellent. I hope so. I mean, this to me is actually a really kind of central and interesting point that I feel like we're not really grasping, which is that what we actually want at the end of the day, what we actually want is computer use. And computer use is the thing that probably, you know, drives general productivity because you're a person that is using the computer, right? You're mm-hmm. learning how to use the computer, and it's the computer that is the productivity enhancing technology, not broadband. And it's the use of the computer that actually increases people's or gives them different and better opportunities and potentially could lead to productivity increases, but it's not the broadband. Yeah. So again, this goes back to the earlier point of being really centrally focused on the demand side of things, that you need to get mm-hmm. people money to, well, not necessarily money, but also other projects to get them online and connected and using computers, not just having a connection just to have a connection.
Well, that's fascinating. So is the infrastructure plan going to pass, do you think, since the House is switch from $1 trillion from the Senate that passed it and sent it to the House with an amendment. And now the House has it and it's $3.5 trillion last time I checked. Do you foresee this coming through?
I think that probably there will, I mean, the House will probably, yeah. I mean, I'm actually, the fact that you saw something pass the Senate, mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm bad at prediction about these things, right?
It does seem encouraging, right?
It does. I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait and see. I mean, I hate to, I really don't like making predictions because I'm constantly surprised by how these things, you know, I did not expect a Senate bill to actually pass. I really didn't at the very, and it seems that there were some provisions that were included within it. Importantly, like NEPA was apparently there's basically some carve outs to NEPA that are being placed or were placed in the Senate bill that allowed for more people to go on, specifically Republicans to sign on to the bill than were expected. So that's something. So for example, that's something I didn't expect would happen. And yet, obviously those provisions are in there and they are kind of wrangling on the other side in the House. So I don't know. We're going to have to wait and see on this one. We're going to have to really
wait and see on it. It's hard to predict politics, isn't it?
I think you have to keep an open mind with politics because I think people are really, really negative about these things. But when push comes to shove, I mean, the fact that we're seeing something pass, you know, the fact that we're seeing something pass the Senate on infrastructure is a day that I don't think that I ever would have expected happen. Right. I've been working in this for, say, 10 years. And I really, this is the first time I've seen, it's not progress, but you see this happen all the time.
It's a sign of.
Yeah. That things aren't as bad as people say they are. I guess that's the point, right? Things are not as bad as people say they are. So I think
we should end on that. People are not as bad as you say they are.
All right. As always, Caden, thanks for having this conversation.
Thanks, Will.